You know, I was reading through our source material for today's deep dive, and there's this one bold claim that really just stopped me in my tracks.
Oh, yeah. Which one?
Well, it basically says that if you want to measure the true height of a civilization, you don't look at its borders and you don't look at its wealth. You look at the grandest engineering it can build by, commanding the forces of nature.
That is a massive statement.
Yeah.
But honestly, it's spot on.
It is, and that is exactly what we are dissecting today for you. We're using a really fascinating set of translated notes and excerpts summarizing a hardware explainer series by the analyst Redknot.
Right.
And our mission today is to understand how humanity managed to tame one of the universe's most unruly forces, which is light.
Yeah, light. It's incredible.
We're going to explore how we use it as this microscopic chisel to carve computer chips, and then brilliantly turn around and use it as a paintbrush to illuminate our screens.
It's a journey you really need to take if you want to
Sure.
understand the modern world. I mean, it is so easy to think of technology as something entirely abstract.
Yeah, totally. Like
Yeah,
magic, almost.
exactly. We talk about, data in the cloud or software algorithms or these massive AI models training in the data center. But all of that abstract tech we rely on, the transistors, the caches, the floating gates that actually hold your photos, they are ultimately physical structures. I mean, they are microscopic cities drawn onto slabs of silicon.
And the primary tool we use to draw those cities, like the hammer and chisel of the modern age, is light.
Yep, light.
Okay, let's unpack this, because if we want to talk about painting with light, we first have to understand how we use it to build the canvas.
Right, the manufacturing side.
Yeah, we have to go from these philosophical heights of human civilization all the way down to the microscopic reality of the factory floor. So, how exactly do we draw a circuit onto a microscopic slab of silicon?
Well, the process is called lithography, and the basic flow is actually quite elegant in its simplicity.
Okay, I like simple.
Right, so imagine you want to put a complex pattern onto a wall. In lithography, you print your circuit pattern onto a template, which we call a mask.
Got it.
Then you take a silicon wafer and coat it in this highly specialized light-sensitive chemical called photoresist.
Photoresist.
And then you shine light through that mask onto the wafer.
So if you're anything like me, you're picturing something like holding a cardboard stencil against a wall and just shining a flashlight through it. The light only passes through the cutouts.
That is the fundamental mechanism, yeah. The light hits the photoresist and chemically changes it. It literally alters the bonds of the polymer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Then you wash the wafer in a developer solution. This chemical bath basically rinses away the altered resist.
Leaving the rest behind.
Exactly. It exposes the bare silicon underneath only in the exact places where the light hit. From there, you just etch away that exposed silicon, and the mask's pattern is now permanently carved into the silicon itself.
Okay, it sounds incredibly straightforward when you put it like that. But obviously, since we're talking about structures measured in nanometers, like billionths of a meter, there has to be a catch, right? We aren't just tracing stencils in a kindergarten class here.
No, definitely not. The catch is, well, it's the nature of light itself.
The unruly force.
Exactly. Once you shrink this manufacturing process down to the nanometer scale, you run headfirst into the main villain of chip manufacturing, which is light's wobbly, wave-like nature.
Okay, so it's not a straight beam.
Right. We've known about this since Thomas Young's double-slit experiment back in 1801. Light is a wave,
Yeah.
and waves do something incredibly frustrating when you try to squeeze them through tiny spaces.
They diffract.
They diffract, yes.
Right. So when light passes through a microscopic narrow slit in that mask, it doesn't just shoot straight through like a perfect laser pointer. Because it's a wave, it fans out to the sides.
Exactly, it spreads.
And the narrower you make that slit to draw your tiny circuits, the wider and blurrier the light gets on the other side.
It is the ultimate engineering bind. You want the circuit to be impossibly fine, but the physics of light literally insists on smearing it out, ruining your crisp line.
That sounds like a nightmare.
Oh, it was. And historically, the industry split into two schools of thought on how to fight this diffraction.
Okay, what were they?
The first is called proximity lithography. The logic here is just pure brute force. You just jam the wafer right up against the mask and expose it before the light has any physical room to spread.
So minimize the distance, minimize the spread. It's like holding a spray paint can right up against the drywall. You get a sharper edge because the paint just doesn't have time to mist out.
That's a great analogy, but doing that carries massive risks of scratching and contaminating the wafer.
Yeah.
They are touching.
Right. And at that microscopic level, a scratch is catastrophic.
Exactly. So the second school is projection lithography. Here, you move the wafer further back to keep it safe, but you place a really complex convex lens in between the mask and the wafer.
Okay, so a lens to fix the blur.
Yes. This lens captures that spreading light, shrinks the mask's pattern down, and focuses it back onto the silicon. In projection, the entire game revolves around a metric called numerical aperture, or NA. A larger lens with a higher NA gathers more of that diffracted escaping light, forcing it back together to make a sharper, tighter image.
But even with the best lenses in the world, I mean, you can't beat physics, right? If the wave is too big, it's going to blur.
Right.
So the only fundamental way to stop the spread is to use a tighter wave to begin with. And in physics, a tighter wave means using a shorter wavelength of light.
That is the golden rule of lithography. Shorter wavelength equals less diffraction, which equals less spread.
Less spread, okay.
And that undeniable logic brings us to one of the most fascinating dead ends in engineering history. Because, you know, if shorter is better, pure logic dictates you should just go as short as possible right away.
And this is where the industry literally poured billions of dollars down the drain. The X-ray bit.
The X-ray bit, yeah.
Our sources detail this multi-decade obsession. Starting in the 1960s and carrying all the way into the 90s, giants like IBM threw massive resources into using X-rays to print chips.
They really did.
And X-rays have a tiny wavelength of just about 1 nanometer. On paper, it sounds like the Holy Grail.
On paper, yes. In physical reality, X-rays are simply too headstrong.
Headstrong. How so?
Think about why we use them in medicine to look at broken bones. They barrel straight through soft tissue and get absorbed by dense bone. They do not bend easily.
Right. They just shoot straight through.
Exactly. And that means they utterly ignore a traditional glass lens.
Wait, I'm stuck. If you can't bend X-rays with a glass lens, how do you focus them down to shrink your circuit pattern?
You don't. That's the catastrophe.
Yeah.
Because you can't use a lens, projection lithography is entirely off the table. You are forced all the way back to proximity lithography.
The brute force spray paint method.
Yes. And doing proximity lithography with X-rays is an absolute nightmare, starting with the mask.
Why?
Well, because you can't optically shrink the image with a lens. Your mask has to be built at a one-to-one scale with the final chip.
Oh.
So if you want a 10-nanometer wire on the chip, you have to physically machine a flawless 10-nanometer gap into your mask. At that scale,
yeah,
it borders on the impossible.
And it gets so much worse, doesn't it? Because of how close you have to hold this mask to the wafer.
Oh, yeah. 10 to 20 microns away.
10 to 20.
To put that in perspective, a human hair is about 70 microns thick.
That is insane.
You are hovering this impossibly delicate mask a fraction of a hair's breadth away from the silicon. This puts you in a highly unstable physical zone called near-field diffraction.
Near-field diffraction. Okay, what does that mean in practice?
In that zone, if the physical gap between the mask and the wafer shifts by even a single micron due to, like, vibration or temperature, the wave interference changes entirely.
In the circuit.
The circuit pattern just crumbles into useless noise.
Unbelievable. But the detail that really highlights how doomed this was is the mask material itself. If X-rays barrel through almost everything, how do you make the solid part of the stencil to block them? The notes say they had to use gold.
Gold is dense enough to absorb the X-rays, yes. But when gold absorbs that massive barrage of X-ray energy, the energy doesn't just vanish.
Right, conservation of energy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It turns into heat. So this delicate, perfectly machined gold film heats up and expands. Then the X-ray turns off, and it cools down and contracts.
Oh.
It does this over and over, expanding and contracting thousands of times during the manufacturing run.
It's just flexing itself to death.
Exactly. Eventually, the metal fatigue kicks in, and the gold simply cracks, destroying a one-to-one mask that cost a fortune to make.
There is a legendary story in our notes about this exact era at IBM. There was this brilliant engineer named Bernjang Lin.
Yes, Lin.
And he was highly skeptical of X-rays and believed the industry needed to focus on deep ultraviolet light instead. The story goes that the X-ray team hit some minor manufacturing milestone, and their management handed out these celebratory T-shirts that proudly said, X-ray works.
This was a bit premature.
Totally. So Lin took his shirt, turned it around, and wrote three words on the back for his colleagues to see as he walked the halls. He wrote, X-ray works for the dentists.
It's hilarious.
Mm.
And history proved his instinct uncomfortably right. The industry ultimately had to abandon the one nanometer dream.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me, though. If X-rays refused to bend for a lens, if the proximity gaps were unstable, and if the gold masks kept cracking, Why did brilliant engineers, literally the smartest people on the planet, spend 30 years trying to force a square peg into a round hole?
I think it shows how blinding a perfect theoretical model can be. When you have a mathematical solution like a 1 nanometer wavelength that essentially eliminates your diffraction problem, it is incredibly hard for brilliant minds to just walk away from it.
Because the math works.
Right. They kept telling themselves, you know, this is just a material science problem. If we can just stabilize the gold, we can just perfect the vibration dampening, we win everything.
But eventually physics wins.
Always. You cannot engineer your way out of the fundamental behaviors of a wavelength.
So, if the 1 nanometer wild stallion couldn't be tamed, the industry had to tuck its tail, go back to projection lenses, and slowly walk down the wavelength spectrum to find something controllable.
Yeah, his methodical, grinding march downward. The industry moved from 436 nanometers down to 248, then 193 nanometers.
And Byrne Jingley, the guy with the dentist joke, he helped with that, right?
He did. He actually saved the industry years of headache by figuring out how to extend the life of 193 nanometer machines by immersing the lenses in water, which bends the light further.
That's so clever.
But eventually, to keep shrinking chips, humanity took a massive, breathtaking leap. We bypassed the intermediate steps and went straight down to 13.5 nanometers.
13.5.
This is what we call extreme ultraviolet, or EUV.
Okay, 13.5 nanometers. It seems like such a specific, arbitrary number. Why land exactly there?
Because it is the absolute edge of what we can physically manipulate. If you go any shorter than 13.5,
yeah,
you start creeping back into X-ray territory, where lenses and mirrors stop working entirely.
Right, the wild stallion territory.
But here's the crazy part. Even at 13.5 nanometers, traditional glass lenses are completely useless.
Really? Why?
The glass just absorbs the extreme ultraviolet light. So you can't shine light through a lens. You have to bounce it.
Wait. If the light is so energetic that it just gets absorbed by glass, how on earth do you bounce it? Wouldn't a normal mirror just absorb it too?
A normal mirror absolutely would. To bounce EUV light, engineers had to invent a highly specialized structure called a Bragg mirror.
A Bragg mirror.
Yeah. You don't just use one reflective surface. You build a mirror out of dozens of incredibly thin alternating layers of two different materials. Specifically, molybdenum and silicon.
Molybdenum and silicon, okay.
They stack about 40 pairs of these layers on top of each other.
Okay, what does stacking alternating metals actually do to the light, though?
It leverages wave physics again. When the 13.5 nanometer light hits the mirror, a tiny fraction of it reflects off the very top layer. The rest penetrates to the second layer, where another tiny fraction reflects, and so on down through the 40 layers.
Like a multi-layered cake of reflection.
Yes. And because the thickness of every single layer is controlled down to the atom, all those tiny separate reflections bounce back up perfectly in sync.
Oh, wow.
Their wave peaks align. This is called constructive interference. The waves add up, multiplying their strength until a powerful cohesive beam reflects out.
That is just incredible.
It is. But even with this absolute masterpiece of atomic engineering, a Bragg mirror still only manages to reflect about 70% of the light.
That is staggering. And, you know, there is a detail from the source right here that blew my mind. Engineers actually know how to build a better version of this mirror.
Oh, the beryllium one.
Yes. There is a molybdenum and beryllium mirror that perfectly reflects an even shorter 11 nanometer light with much higher efficiency. It actually exists. We know the math. So why don't we use it?
Well, because beryllium is severely toxic.
Exactly. It's so toxic that no human being could safely work in the fabrication plant. The dust would literally destroy their lungs. It is such a stunning reminder that our engineering isn't just bound by the laws of physics. It's bound by human fragility. To spare our own bodies, we just had to settle for 13.5 nanometers.
We really are the ultimate bottleneck in our own manufacturing process. But through this incredible multi-decade journey, we did figure out how to tame this 13.5 nanometer light. We mastered it as a microscopic chisel to carve cities into silicon.
But the deep dive takes a massive turn here. We just spent 30 years and billions of dollars trying to force light to carve microscopic gaps in silicon. But the cruel irony is that when we finally perfected those microscopic gaps, we accidentally created the exact physical environment needed to make silicon trap light and glow. We go from using light as a chisel to using it as a paintbrush.
This is where it gets really fun.
Yeah.
Let's look at the science of glowing.
Okay, lay it on me.
At a fundamental atomic level, an electron sits at a specific comfortable energy level orbiting an atom.
Mm-hmm.
If you inject energy into that atom, say,
right,
running electricity through it, that electron gets excited and jumps up to a higher energy level.
Makes sense.
But it hates being up there. It wants to return to its resting state. when it inevitably falls back down, it releases that stored energy, and it releases it as light.
Okay, so jumping up and falling down makes light.
Yes. And the rule here is strict. The bigger the drop, the higher the energy of the light, which translates to bluer light. A smaller drop releases lower energy, which looks red.
But doing this in a standard piece of silicon isn't easy, is it? The notes refer to this as the big crystal problem.
Right. In a large, macroscopic, crystal-like a chunk of silicon, you could just hold in your hand. Electrons roam freely across millions of atoms.
Makes it so big.
Because of how all those atoms interact, those distinct clean energy levels we just talked about. They shatter. They blur into a near continuous smear of energy states.
So it's kind of like a pinball machine. In a massive crystal, the energy just bounces around, hitting a million different bumpers, stepping down slowly and losing energy as heat. But we want it to drop straight down the middle and flash the jackpot light.
That's a perfect way to visualize it. When an electron is injected with energy in a big crystal, it doesn't drop in one massive leap. It shuffles down a dense staircase of tiny overlapping drops.
Taking the stairs.
Yeah. And instead of releasing a burst of pure visible light, it releases that energy as infrared radiation. Heat. If you run electricity through a big crystal of silicon, it just warms up. It doesn't glow.
I love the analogy Redknott used in the notes here to explain this. The one about the strong man.
Oh, yes.
Imagine a strong man hurling you onto a 20-story rooftop. If you jump straight down in one massive leap, bam, you flash into light.
Assuming you survive the fall as an electron, yes.
Right. But if you take the stairs all the way down from the 20th floor, all you get is a sweat, which is heat.
Exactly.
So how do we remove the bumpers? How do we force the electron to jump off the top floor instead of taking the stairs?
You shrink the crystal. You take it all the way down to just a few nanometers wide.
Back to the nanoscale.
Always. By physically confining the electron in such a tight microscopic space, it can't roam. Those smeared, overlapping energy levels snap back into discrete, separate gaps.
The staircase vanishes.
The staircase is gone. The electron is forced to do the massive jump and fall again. When it falls, it creates a pure, clean glow of visible light. This confined structure is what we call a quantum dot.
A quantum dot?
Yes. And the discovery and synthesis of quantum dots was so revolutionary that it won the 2023 Nobel Prize in Chemistry.
And the most elegant part of this, the part that feels like sheer magic to me, is how we control the colors. By simply changing the physical size of the dot, you literally change the color of the light.
It's direct physical control over a quantum property. If you make the crystal smaller, the confinement gets tighter, which forces the energy gaps to get wider.
A wider gap means a bigger drop.
Which produces high energy, blue or green light. If you make the crystal slightly larger, the gap shrinks, the drop is smaller, and you get red light. You control the physical diameter of the dot, and you can point to any exact color on the spectrum.
Which is exactly how high-end LCD TVs work today. They take a backlight of high-energy blue light and blast it through a sheet of these tiny quantum dots.
Yep.
The smaller dots absorb the blue and emit pure green. The larger ones absorb it and emit pure red. Mix those perfectly pure reds and greens with the original blue, and you get an incredibly bright, pure white light that completely blows away older display tech.
Quantum dots basically give us screens with perfect, pure color reproduction.
But we aren't stopping at TVs in our living rooms. The source material takes us to the absolute bleeding edge here. How do you take that perfect screen and put it directly into a person's eye without blocking their view of the real world?
We are talking about augmented reality, or AR.
Right, AR.
To understand the massive engineering challenge of AR, we have to contrast it with virtual reality.
Okay, VR.
In VR, it's easy. You just strap a screen an inch from your face and block out the whole world.
Easy enough.
But in AR, you need to see the digital image overlaid seamlessly onto the physical world around you. The early attempt at this was called the birdbath method.
Birdbath?
Yeah, you put a screen up high on the top rim of a thick pair of glasses and use a curved half mirror to fold the image down and bounce it into your eye.
And it was named that because the spherical mirror literally looked like a birdbath.
Exactly.
But the problem is it's way too thick and dim, right? You can't wear a birdbath on your face while walking down the street.
Far too clunky. So to make AR glasses look like normal Ray-Bans, engineers moved to a technology called waveguides.
Waveguides. Oh,
they tuck a tiny high-resolution screen into the temple arm of the glasses, the part that goes over your ear.
Oh, hidden away.
Right. They then use the glass lens of the spectacles itself as a pipe. Through a physics principle called total internal reflection, the light enters the edge of the glass and bounces back and forth inside the lens, trapped like water in a pipe, until it reaches the area right in front of your eye, where it's intentionally released.
So think of it like skipping a stone across a perfectly calm lake.
Yeah.
As long as the stone hits the water at a shallow enough angle, it bounces instead of sinking.
Perfect analogy.
The light bounces off the inside of the glass until it hits a specially designed exit point. But waveguides immediately run into a brutal physics trap that the industry dramatically calls AR's impossible triangle.
It consists of three competing metrics. First, field of view, which is how much of your vision the digital image actually fills.
Okay, field of view.
Second, the eye box, which is how far your physical eye can roam, twitch, or look around while still seeing the full image.
Right.
And finally, lens size. The triangle dictates a harsh geometric reality. If you push one of these, you break the others.
Okay, mechanically, why does making the picture wider ruin where my eye can look? Why does pushing field of view break the eye box?
It comes down to the geometry of those bouncing light rays inside the glass. If you want a wide field of view, you have to inject the light into the glass at much steeper angles so it spreads out to cover your peripheral vision.
Makes sense.
But if the light is bouncing at a steeper angle, it takes fewer skips to travel across the lens. Because it's bouncing fewer times, it only hits the exit area in a very narrow, localized spot. It exits in a tight cone.
Oh, I see.
So if your pupil isn't positioned perfectly inside that tiny millimeter-wide cone, if you twitch your eye even slightly to the left, the digital image completely vanishes. You've ruined the eye box to get a wide image.
Wait, if we figured out how to beat diffraction back in the lithography days with massive lenses and Bragg mirrors, why is this so hard to solve in a pair of glasses?
To fix the eye box, can't engineers just open up several exit points along the glass to give the eye more room to move?
They try. They use intricate patterns etched into the glass called diffraction gratings to release the light at multiple points.
Okay, so that solves it.
Well, the moment you use a diffraction grating, you summon our old enemy from the lithography chapter.
Diffraction.
Yes, diffraction. And in a display lens, the diffraction trap is devastating for color.
Because different colors of light have different wavelengths. Exactly. Red light has a longer wavelength than blue light. And because they have different wavelengths, they diffract or bend at slightly different angles when they hit that exit grating.
So if you send a crisp, full-color image down the arm of the glasses, the red, green, and blue light all bend at different angles and exit the glass completely misaligned.
The RGB gets completely scrambled. The resulting image that hits your retina looks beaten up. It has bruised, blurry, rainbow-colored edges. It's a complete mess.
Wow. So what does this all mean for the augmented reality glasses you or I might actually go out and buy right now?
It explains a very noticeable trend in the market. Many of the early sleek AR glasses you see settle for rendering the digital world in a single color.
Just one color.
Often they just use monochrome green. Aligning three separate wavelengths through diffraction is brutally hard, and human eyes happen to be most sensitive to green light anyway.
That's fascinating.
Furthermore, because you lose so much light bouncing it through the glass and out the gratings, and because you have to compete with the bright sun outside, these glasses have to use brutally bright micro-LED screens.
So they just overpower the problem.
Pretty much. They essentially have to muscle a singular, incredibly intense green image into your vision just to make it legible.
It is incredible to pull back and look at the grand synthesis of everything we've talked about today. I mean, from Thomas Young's double-slit experiment in 1801 proving light is a wave, to IBM's disastrous gold X-ray masks, to engineers building 13.5 nanometer EUV Bragg mirrors just to chisel a silicon chip.
It's a wild ride.
And then from electrons shuffling down the stairs in a big crystal to confining them in glowing quantum dots and finally battling diffraction all over again inside the lens of AR glasses.
It really is something.
The entire history of modern tech, as our sources point out, is really just a single ongoing act. Humanity taking electricity and light, two of the universe's most wild, unruly forces, and pressing them bit by bit into the palm of our hand.
It is a profound achievement of species-level engineering. But, you know, the notes from Red Knot end on a very sobering physical reality.
Oh, what's that?
The author is actually quite pessimistic about the immediate future. He believes that silicon-based scaling, which is currently eyeing a move down to 6.7 nanometers, has a real, unavoidable physical ceiling approaching rapidly.
We're hitting a wall.
He suspects we are finally reaching the end of the road for what manipulating light and silicon can do together.
But Red Knot also offers a counterbet, noting that for 100 years, every single time a brilliant physicist stood up and said, "This is it, this is the absolute limit," human engineering found a way to push just one inch further.
We always seem to find a way.
And that tension between physical limits and human ingenuity leaves you with a brand new question to mull over as we wrap up today.
If Red Knot is right, and we do eventually hit the absolute unbreakable physical limit of what light and silicon can do together, will the next great leap in civilization require us to abandon light and silicon entirely?
It's a big question. If the height of a civilization is measured by the grandest engineering it can build by commanding nature, maybe our next true leap forward will force us to tame a completely new force of the universe from scratch. See you next time on The Deep Dive.